Well, can we all? You've had your chance to talk. According to my watch, it's my turn now. I want to welcome all of you. It's a pleasure to get together and to continue our exploration of the Bible. First of all, I'd like to point out that in the regular Bible that we use in our services, which is the Eitz Chaim Bible, it begins with these words. When God began to create heaven and earth, it does not begin with the words that we are so accustomed to. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, in our text, Christine Hayes makes quite a big point of that. And she indicates and provides in the text her translation, which is exactly what we find in the Eitz Chaim. What's the big difference? Why is that important? In the beginning, which is the very popular way of beginning the Bible, in the beginning God created Bereishit. And this text, which says, when God began to create the heaven and the earth. Okay. What's the big difference? Anybody? Yes? What? Not only God already created, because one of the sort of idle questions that you quote small children asking, well, who created God? But in addition to that, what else already existed? What?
The darkness.
Darkness.
Well, darkness is a condition. Water existed and earth existed. What God did was not to create, and this is a famous phrase in Greek philosophy of Aristotle. Creatio ex nihilo, creating something out of nothing. If you begin the Bible with, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth, what you are saying is that God created something out of nothing. But if you say when God created, he was already doing it. Something existed already, namely water and earth. And then the act of creation continued. Okay, then we talked last week about the fact that this story ends at chapter 2, verse 4. What's the story of the introduction to the Bible as we read it? The story simply is the various days of creation. On the first day, light, etc. And finally, man is created, mankind. Actually, the man that is created in the first story is really an earthling. It's man-woman. Man and woman created simultaneously. As the ultimate form of creation, the highest form of creation. And then God rested. There's no talk there about Garden of Eden or of man and woman, Adam and Eve, or anything. That's the end of that story. And then when we come to chapter 2, verse 4, as I pointed out, the verse begins with the words, Eile toldot hashamayim v'ha'aretz. This is the history. Toldot is history. Generations. This is the history of heaven and earth. That's the way a book begins. In other words, this was a very different story about creation. I also pointed out that the first story of creation uses the term Elohim completely. Now, all of a sudden, Adonai is introduced. The form of Elohim and Adonai as words for gods are very different from each other. Elohim, you remember, comes from the Canaanite term for God, El or Elohim. Elohim is a master god, a distant, all-powerful god, who, as in the first version of the introduction, creates heaven and earth. How does he create it? In every instance, by saying, let there be, is all he has to do. And it was. This is an extraordinarily powerful God whose word creates. Adonai is very different. The Adonai that we talk about here in this second version, Eile toldot hashamayim v'ha'aretz. And it goes on to say, Biyom Asot Adonai, on the day that Yahweh, Adonai, created. This God is a very different kind of a God. In the first version, how was Adam and Eve, the earthling, created? In the same way that everything else was created. Let there be. In the second one, Adonai takes clay, works the clay, fashions the clay, and makes Adam, man. He places man in the Garden of Eden, which makes life perfect, ideal. Nobody has to work. All you have to do is just to collect food from the earth. Ideally, man is a vegan. There's no killing of any kind, animals or human beings. And we talked about this a lot last week, he only tells him that there are two trees that he cannot eat from, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life, of eternal life. Pointed out that in none of the contemporary literature of the ancient world, mainly in Babylonia or in Egypt, there is never any reference to anything like a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Totally absent. But the idea of a tree of life is widely found. And we're going to talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh, which illustrates that. When Adam and Eve find, after eating from the tree of knowledge, that they are naked, they feel a sense of shame. And God makes for them clothing. God cares for them. God walks around in the Garden of Eden. And then eventually mankind is driven out of the Garden of Eden because suddenly, as the text puts it, suddenly God says to himself, what am I going to do if they eat from the tree of life? I'm going to be stuck with man forever. He'll never die. So God expels mankind from the Garden of Eden to prevent man from eating of the tree of life. So man has made a choice between, and I love this phrase of Christine Hayes, man has made a choice between morality and mortality. You're either going to live a moral life or have immortal life. And it's more important for the Jew to adopt a life of morality than to achieve immortality. It's a price you pay. So basically, the story ends when mankind Well, I should say, put it this way. The story changes, not ends. The story changes for mankind when he is driven out of the Garden of Eden. Then the second story, which we are in now, tells the story of the two children that are born to Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. You're all very familiar with that story. But I want to point out the story of Cain and Abel is a real puzzle. It's hard to understand in terms of a Jewish Bible. What the story is, as you know, Cain is a farmer. Abel is a shepherd. God prefers the offering of Abel to the offering of Cain. Well, that's fairly understandable because the early Jews, certainly in biblical times, were wanderers. They were shepherds. They were like Bedouins going from place to place. Farmers settled down in land and built cities. And the idea continues right down to the present day, namely, cities are dens of iniquity. In cities, you have gangs and drugs and all kinds of evil things. But when people live as farmers or as shepherds close to nature, they live a purer life. So God preferred the offering of the shepherd to the offering of the farmer, which is, in those days, the beginnings of the cities. But what is not understandable, what's very curious, Cain is so jealous of Abel that God prefers Abel's offerings or sacrifices rather than his. And like an angry, jealous person, he kills his brother. Kills Abel. Well, what's the Jewish response to that crime? Well, the Jewish response, we all know, is embodied in the idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, famous phrase. Namely, if you take a life, your life has to be given. The concept of the death penalty for murder is very clearly within the framework of Jewish law, biblical law. There's even a whole section in the Bible about protection for somebody who accidentally kills someone else. Normally, anybody who kills anyone else would be put to death by the court. But in the Bible, they established cities of refuge. Six cities three on one side of the Jordan and three on the other. So that if a person accidentally causes the death of another person, he can come to the city of refuge and his life would be spared. But otherwise, murder, which is one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder. It is not thou shalt not kill, but thou shalt not murder intentionally. Well, Cain murdered Abel intentionally, out of jealousy. We have a motive, we have an action, and that action could have been responded to only by death to Cain. But that doesn't happen. How is Cain punished? He's forced to leave, and a mark is placed upon his forehead, the mark of Cain. Why was the mark placed upon him? Deliberately, so that anyone who sees that mark will not kill Cain. It's to protect him from anyone who wants to revenge the death that he committed. Is that how you treat a murderer? Not only that, the Bible says further that if anybody kills Cain, that he will be punished sevenfold or over. I don't know how you can pay seven times as much for a life. But the idea being that Cain goes free under unfavorable circumstances. He goes free with everybody knowing that he is a murderer. I would translate that in modern terms, life in prison. He's living a life in a form of prison where nobody will have anything to do with him because he murdered. But it's very clear, as we read the rest of the Bible, that that approach to a murderer was not followed in Jewish law. But it is followed in this story of Cain and Abel following the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. But now take a look at chapter 5. Okay, chapter 5. In the Hebrew, Ze Sefer Toldot Adam Biyom bara Elohim Adam, bidmut Elohim asaoto. In this translation, it says, this is the record. But I think everybody here knows what the word sefer means, and we don't usually translate it as record. How do we translate the word sefer? A book. Sefer Torah is the book of the Torah. So this chapter 5 begins with the words, Ze Sefer, this is the book of the Toldot Adam, of the generations of Adam. This is where the Bible really begins. Now, from here on, we have a constant succession of generations all the way to the end of the Bible. Because what happened, Abel was killed, Cain disappeared somewhere of all places, the land of Nod, N-O-D. Nobody knows where the land of Nod is. It's somewhere. He's gone. We don't know anything about his family any further. So this is where it begins. So, why do you think the Bible has three beginnings? It all comes, as we know now, from the notion called the documentary theory, that the Bible is generally, no scholars really believe any longer in the traditional story that the Bible, the five books of Moses, or the Bible, was given by God word for word to Moses, that it's made up of various documents. And we talked about that last week as well, about Wellhausen, who was the leader of that school of thought. And one of the ways that we identify the various documents is by whether they use the word Elohim or Yahweh for God. I'll give you another example later on today. So anyway, you have all of these documents, and then eventually someone or some group of people put it all together in the Bible. They canonized the Bible. So just thinking to myself, here you have three different texts that were found. Each one began with the words. One of them, when God formed heaven and earth. This is the story of the forming of the heaven and earth. And this is the book of the story of the first man. Three different ways of studying the Bible. To me, the answer seems to be clearly. It depends on what you thought was most important. Now, I made an allusion to that last week. When the Bible begins with the story of creation, as it does in our Bible, and it comes to an end with the description of Shabbat, because that was considered the most important thing about the Bible to that particular scholar. This is how the world came to be. One day after another, and then the Shabbat, on Shabbat, God rested, and we rest, and we observe the Shabbat primarily because we are created in the image of God. Now begins Eilat Toldot. This is the story of Adam and Eve and of Cain and Abel. And it ends with the end of the story of Cain. Now, whoever put that at the beginning of the Bible must have thought that that was the important teaching of that particular section. Well, what was important? What's so great about the story of Cain and Abel that the first introduction begins and ends with the story of Cain? Why is that important?
Justice.
Well, it's obviously important because we're dealing with that topic today.
Choice.
Namely, the taking of a life as a punishment for the taking of a life is not the correct action. You can punish in any way you want, like punishing Cain. You can punish by putting people in prison for life. You can do all kinds of things. But to take a person's life because that person took another person's life is not moral. That was his opinion. Now, the Bible itself, though, reverses the approach. The Bible itself, later on, does have death penalties. It just shows the struggles that go on in the creation of the Bible in thinking through these problems, which still trouble us. I tell you personally, it troubles me a great deal. I remember when I went down to Salem to participate in a rally against the death penalty. And I felt very strongly about that. But I have to admit, there have been so many occasions since then when I was absolutely in favor of the death penalty. I was in favor of it, and yet I felt there was something wrong with the way I was feeling. And I don't think that I was alone in that regard. Now we come to the third introduction, chapter 5. That I just alluded to. Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. This is the beginning of the story of man. You know, it's interesting, I'll point out, one of the ways in which the Bible, I mean, the commentators on the Bible early on made this statement. The Bible begins with the letter bet, right? You know how a bet is formed? Three sides of whatever it is, either an octagon or
a rectangle.
In other words, there's a roof, there's a wall, and there's a bottom. At the beginning of the Bible, what these rabbis said. This is to show that what the Bible is really about is human beings, how human beings should live. It's not about the solar system, the heavens above, and it's not about below the earth that we can explore. You know, I had an interesting conversation just the other day with someone who said he remembers that some years back, a statement was made that one of the greatest mistakes that the world made in recent years was embarking upon a space program. He said, if you think about the billions of dollars that have gone into space exploration that could have been used for human needs, for feeding people, for housing people, making this a better world. What do we gain, actually, in any real terms, about going up into space? That's a point of view. And what the rabbi said about the use of bet is in that same vein. Namely, the purpose of learning should be to improve life. Now, I've been trying to figure out how my life has been improved by the fact that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. Yes. What?
Where the noise stops.
Oh.
Please use the microphone.
Okay. The knowledge and the Torah's knowledge is really based on, should be focused upon, human beings and what they've accomplished and what they should be accomplishing and what they should be striving for. In other words, if the Bible really began with chapter 5, the Sefer Toldot Adam, and the first child that was born was not Cain or Abel, but Seth, and that all human beings are descended from Seth. The rest of the Bible follows. Now, what follows is another interesting observation that that Christine Hayes makes to the substance of the Bible. And that is the story of Noah. Now, after Seth, we had generations of mankind. We have all these long-lived ancient people like Methuselah and so on, until we come to Noah. By the time we come to Noah, the Bible comes to the conclusion, and it says so almost specifically. God said to himself, I made a terrible mistake. Now that in itself is remarkable. Does God make mistakes? Isn't what God does always perfect? Look what it says at the end of Bereshit. The Lord saw how great was man's wickedness on earth, and how every plan devised by his mind was nothing but evil all the time. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on earth, and his heart was saddened. The whole thing failed. Why did it fail? Because this man that God had created, mankind, had eaten from the tree of knowledge. And when you know the difference between good and evil, and you have free choice, this man chose consistently to do evil. So, what am I going to do? I'm going to destroy the world. Kill them all off. But there was one fly in the ointment. To kill everybody off by this great flood, he could do. But somehow or other, there was one oddball, Noah, who was good. Now, I want to contrast that with the story of the Bible of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, these were evil cities. Everybody there was evil. And God wanted to destroy them. And Abraham argued with God, a famous conversation that they had, coming down basically to, what if there are 10 good people? And he said, well, if there were 10, but there aren't 10. But Abraham never went down to one. What would have happened if the Bible had said that Abraham said to God, what if there was one good person in Sodom? Would you have destroyed Sodom? I'll never know why Abraham didn't want to pin God down on that. Because this is what happened with Noah. No, we're not talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, the whole world. And the world was saved in this story. Now, the story of the flood, in general, is a story that was very well known in the ancient world. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, which the book tells you the whole story of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Essentially, Gilgamesh is a king of in Babylonia, ancient Babylonia, the king of Uruk. And he encounters death in the death of his closest friend, Enkidu. He's so troubled by death, so frightened by death, that he goes to all over the world looking for a way to overcome death. When I read the Epic of Gilgamesh, I read about people today who will go to all parts of the world because they hear that there is some cure for cancer that was found somewhere in South America or in Asia, somewhere. They'll do anything, pay anything to find that. So he goes to a man by the name of Utnapishtim, who survives the flood and apparently has a secret of eternal life. And there in the Epic of Gilgamesh, they tell a story about Utnapishtim and the flood and an ark and the animals and so on. Very similar to the story in the Bible of Noah and the flood. So the story of the flood is known in the ancient world, and it's told again in the Bible with this twist. In the story of Gilgamesh and Utnapishtim, why did the flood came to destroy the world? Again, very similar to that part of the story that I talked about last week, the Enuma Elish. Why did Marduk, the god, create the world as we know it? You remember, because the gods were disturbed, the top gods were disturbed by the other gods making a lot of noise. Here too, the same element arises that God wanted to bring the flood over on the entire world because mankind was too noisy, disturbing them. They wanted peace and quiet. In the Bible story, it's not that reason. There again, there's the reason of behavior and wrongdoing. Because human beings were doing evil, that's why the flood was taking place. But even in the flood story in the Bible, you have two flood stories. In one regard particularly, well, actually in several. But in one of them it says that Noah got his family and extended family into the ark to save them from the flood. And then it says he brought two of all the animals of the world, which is a very favorite story for children and toys that are made of all the animals, giraffes, rhinoceros, elephants, everything. In the other story of the world, in the flood, it says that Noah was told to take seven kosher animals into the ark. Now, what were the kosher animals that they had in the Middle East where the flood took place? Basically, sheep and goats. So he didn't have all of the animals in the world, but very practical. Sheep and goats were brought into the ark for what purpose? What?
Sacrifice.
Food. Food. In other words, in one version of the story, the ark was like a zoo. Two of all the animals of the world. In the other version of the story, there were just animals that are permitted to be eaten, kosher, because it's the Bible says tahor, pure animals, kosher animals. Now, if you look at these two stories in the book, in the story of Noah, which story do you think was conducted or ordered by Elohim, and which was ordered by Yahweh? Now, how about the zoo? Who ordered the zoo, do you think? What?
Elohim.
And who ordered the kosher animals? Yahweh. They're two different kinds of gods with two different interests. One was grand and, overblown. You know, they did have zoos in the ancient world that the kings created just for amusement. But Yahweh was not the god for kings, was essentially the god for human beings. And the same God that created Adam out of clay told Noah to bring seven kosher animals into the ark. So these are little insights into the Bible that really help us to understand these stories. They're not just stories. Stories emanate from authors, writers, who want to convey a message. And then our job is to discover and extract the message from the text. So, I'll leave a little bit of time, not very much, but whatever, for any observations or questions that you might have.
Please wait for the microphone. You won't be audible without it.
What?
Please, everybody, wait for the microphone. The
microphone is ready.
It's
not on.
It is on.
It is on. Ed says it's on.
It is on.
No, who can't hear me? Fred, can you hear me? Thank you. I was listening to, as we all were, the relationship with God and man, and it seems to me that one of the observations is that man is important to God as God is important to man.
Right.
Because without man, God doesn't exist. Because it's like the sound of a tree falling in the woods. So this idea of man being so important that you cannot kill him is a reflection of God's need to have us as his servants, and it's important for us to be part of his world. That's why he doesn't want man to be killed. That was kind of what I got out of it anyway.
Right. And man is created by Yahweh in the image of God. And just as God serves humankind, man has to serve humankind. Yeah.
So in chapter 7, verse 2, while it talks about seven pairs of the clean animals, it also acknowledges that God still allows single pairs of the unclean animals so that no animal is wiped off the face of the earth totally, so that they may survive that species.
So what's your question, Sherry?
Just an observation, Rabbi.
What?
An observation about maintaining the species of even the unclean animals. He still allowed one pair of each of the unclean animals and seven pairs of the clean animals. So no species was wiped out totally.
Well, one thing that I should point out too, in the Garden of Eden, man was limited, as I mentioned before, to vegetarian food. When the flood took place, when God saw that the man that he had created turned out to be so evil, and God basically started all over again with Noah. God, and I think Christine Hayes makes this comment. I think she used the words, God recalibrated. Remember that term? Recalibrated. There was a big shift in God's thinking. God recalibrated and rethought the nature of this man that God had created that proved to be so bad. One of the ways in which he recalibrated was to recognize that man eats meat and to make it available to mankind. with the exception that when he does eat kosher meat, he removes the blood to symbolically indicate that he's not taking the life of the animal, only the flesh of the animal. I'm going to say something very odd right now. And I'm really, if you don't agree with me, please feel free not to. I think today, the Roman Catholic Church is recalibrating. The Roman Catholic Church has always had the policy of priests who could never marry, could never have wives. In the light of what's going on, of the enormous damage that has been done to so many thousands and thousands of children by Roman Catholic priests, that it's created a crisis in the Roman Catholic Church, it's time for them to recalibrate.
So, given everything that you've said, if there are two definitions or views of God, wouldn't you say that man's recalibrated God in the two different stories you've talked about?
Well, I indicated that one of the interesting things about this whole business is that so much of it can be traced by the document that's being used. Yes. I'm not saying that the authors of those documents recalibrated or didn't, but they did reflect very often opposing points of view. So we can find in the Bible conservative points of view and liberal points of view. And that's part of the Bible. You can find proof for conservatism and proof for liberalism in the Bible, and stand on good ground on either one. Not that it makes life easier. Okay, we're going to get now into the story of the Jewish people. So far, we've been talking about the world itself. Can I just take a couple of minutes? I want to make one more observation. One of the things that Cynthia Hayes does that's very helpful to us, you find there a list of the Noahide laws, the laws that God gave to Noah. There were seven of them. Not to worship idols, not to curse God, to establish courts of law, not to murder, commit adultery, not to steal, not to eat flesh from a living animal. The reason that the Noahide laws are important, and I just wanted to make this comment, when it comes to law, it's always been assumed that the law is the law of the land. Who makes laws? Governments make laws. Who made Jewish laws? The Jewish government, originally led by Moses. It's only in modern times that we began to recognize that there are laws that are universal, that apply to all governments and all peoples. That really came to our attention with the Nuremberg trial, when all of the crimes committed by the Nazi government were judged in a universal court, even though all of the murders that they committed of the millions of Jews and others were done legally. They were done by the government. They were crimes. Noahide laws is the first example in all of history where laws were indicated how all human beings should act. And they might ask the question, who is Moses to tell us how to behave? In the same way that the Nazis could claim, who are you to say that we violated the law? We created our laws. But there's inherently the idea of crimes against humanity. And what is listed here is what they regarded as crimes against humanity. It's such an important notion that we ought to take with us. Anyway, thank you so much for your patience.